From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. This week on Soundings, conversations about beginnings in American cultural and scientific history. My guests are two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, William Rorabaugh of the University of Washington and Seymour Cohen of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. On the first part of this week's program, a discussion with William Rorabaugh about his forthcoming book on apprenticeship in American history. Following that, a conversation with Seymour Cohen about his forthcoming study of Thomas Cooper, one of the founders of American scientific inquiry. The practice of apprenticeship in America came to these shores from England as one result of the system of medieval merchant guilds. Prominent among early American apprentices are men such as Benjamin Franklin and Horace Greeley. According to William Rorabaugh, apprenticeship in America extends from the time of the American Revolution through the end of the Civil War, when the rise of mechanization and the subsequent development of the service industries marked its decline. Here is William Rorabaugh.
Well, apprentices were an important part of the American economy and American life. Mm-hmm. In the past, one always thinks of Benjamin Franklin as the most famous of all apprentices.
Mm-hmm. What happened to him? I mean, did he institutionalize it? Certainly doesn't begin with Franklin.
No, apprenticeship goes back back maybe to Roman times, uh-huh. and certainly through the Middle Ages. I think the one general comment that could be made is that apprenticeship was always a somewhat uncomfortable state because it was adolescent. It was a part of the transition from childhood to adulthood. And as we know, in all societies, that is always a difficult period of time for young people.
A time of growing up.
Apprenticeship enabled people to hold their status in society.
Uh-huh.
They probably, some of them rose, but from lower unskilled ranks into the ranks of skilled crafts. But by and large, it's a way for a son of a skilled craftsman to remain in the skilled craft ranks and therefore be middle class.
All right, now you're talking about sons of skilled craftsmen. What does apprenticeship have to do with class in America? We are supposed to be a classless society. Any connection there?
In the colonial period, there were really only four classes in American society.
And what were they?
There were agricultural people, mm-hmm. farmers and farm laborers who aspired to become farmers. Then there were skilled craftsmen. There were a small number of merchants and professionals at the top of the social and economic order.
And then what, the clergy?
Well, that's the professionals.
Okay.
Include the ministers, doctors, and lawyers, and merchants would
okay.
be a sort of separate class. And then finally, there would be the unskilled laborers of the cities.
And they're the ones on the very
and
bottom.
And they're on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the system. The skilled craftsmen viewed themselves as the backbone of the republic, as the basis of the middle class, as nearly a majority of the population of the urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
They had some things in common with the merchants and the professionals. They were interested in law and order, preservation of property. For example, I mean, if you're a skilled craftsman, you're very interested in preserving property because you have property that you'd want preserved of your own. This separates the skilled craftsmen from the unskilled laborers.
Bill, tell me, comment for me about apprentices and apprenticeship in terms of what we might call American social values. For instance, education as an institution or as a beginning sort of social force. How did apprentices and apprenticeship connect with education in colonial America?
Well, in the old days, in the colonial period, apprenticeship was a kind of substitute for education.
Uh-huh.
A child would go to early school for, you know, 3 or 4 years, maybe 5 or 6, and then be apprenticed at the age of 12 or 13 or 14 for a period of 5 or 6 or 7 years. Sometimes the apprentice went to school part-time while he was an apprentice. This would depend on the trade. It would depend on conditions of business. It would depend on the availability of a school. It would depend on how kind a master he had. It would also depend on whether the apprentice had any interest in going to school. Mm-hmm. But essentially, apprenticeship was a way of transferring knowledge from one generation to the next without having a formal system of education. And it's very interesting that the period when apprenticeship begins to really decline in the 1820s and 30s is exactly the period when public education is rising, and indeed the people who make the greatest clamor for free public schools are skilled craftsmen who see that the old system of putting your children out as apprentices into somebody else's craft is no longer viable because these crafts are dying out. I mean, here you are, you're a tailor, mm-hmm. and you have a son who isn't very good at using a needle and thread, perhaps, but might make a great, I have to think of another craft, might
shoemaker.
Make a great shoemaker.
Sure.
Then you can't make him a shoemaker because, well, you can. If you can give him a so-called apprenticeship as a shoemaker, but in fact he will only learn how to tend a machine, which means he'll be doomed to spend the rest of his life as a factory worker. And we still have not come to terms with adolescence. It's very interesting that the phrase juvenile delinquency mm-hmm. begins in New York City in the 1820s during the very decade that apprenticeship is dying out. People, in other words, young people in the old traditional society had a place. Between the young males between the ages of 13 and 21 were supposed to be apprentices. They were supposed to follow certain rules. They didn't always follow all the rules, but they knew what they were supposed to be. They knew where they were supposed to be and what they were supposed to be doing. Furthermore, they knew that there was a strong connection between whether they learned the trade or not and what would happen to their subsequent lives.
Well, now, are you saying in a very general sense that we have never grown up? is that it? How does apprenticeship connect with this idea of social maturity?
I don't think it's that we've never grown up. I think as a society, we have not yet faced up to the problem of what to do with people between the ages of 13 and 21.
Okay, so you're isolating that section of the population. You're not saying that we have not matured.
Yes, I wouldn't want to make a larger claim. I think it's a very significant claim. If you think about, for example, Growing Up Absurd, mm-hmm. a book of about 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, the problems that were pointed out in Growing Up Absurd and the whole question of teenage gangs, which has been around for the last 30 or 40 years. I mean, these are problems. These are social problems. Drug use today among teenagers, another social problem. These are all social problems which go back to the fact that we liquidated and abolished the institution of apprenticeship, and we did not replace it with anything that was fully satisfactory. Because, as has been pointed out for 100 years, the academic high school that was created partly to replace apprenticeship only works for people who have some sort of interest in academic things.
Well, now, wait, we have vocational high schools, but we don't have enough of them, is that right?
Well, the problem with vocational high schools is that they, as the students know full well, they usually don't train people for anything useful. Mm-hmm. You see, you go back again to the fact that apprenticeship, if you were an apprentice and you were 17 years old and you were learning how to be a printer, it was important for you to learn how to be a printer because your livelihood and your status in society were going to depend upon that knowledge. If you go to a vocational high school and you don't do something or you do something, what difference does it make?
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this, Bill. What, in your view of apprentices and apprenticeship, early or late in American culture, when it was happening and the inheritance that we have, what does race have to do with that? You mentioned a minute ago the problem of teenage gangs and delinquency. It's a commonplace in the headlines that black youth, minority youth, I suppose, have trouble finding jobs. What's the connection?
Well, going all the way back, race has always been involved as an issue around apprenticeship. It was difficult for people of minority races, that is essentially for black Americans in the colonial period, to be apprenticed to skilled crafts that would lead them to higher status in life. Mm-hmm. And of course, slaves were usually not apprenticed, although slaves did sometimes learn somewhat elementary craftsmanship on the plantation, which was passed down from generation to generation of slaves. But the institution of apprenticeship was in part responsible for the creation of a permanent underclass.
So it was a mechanism for exclusion, I take it.
Yes. So although, of course, to put it the other way, the people who created the institution, the artisans themselves, saw it as a way to preserve the status of their own families from generation to generation. And what is striking is that one does not find that a carpenter's son will be a carpenter always, but one does find that a carpenter's son will almost always be a skilled craftsman, and just as a tailor's son would also be a skilled craftsman. And so it's a perpetual middle class, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at most of the leaders of American society in the past 200 years, they come from families where parents were merchants or in the professions, or
in other words,
farmers,
not apprentices,
but not skilled craftsmen, yeah. and they themselves were not apprentices, right?
Yeah. Bill, comment for me about the connections between apprentices and apprenticeship, and did it have anything to do with spiritual values, with American religion, with the preachers, the clergy?
Well, yes, religion and apprenticeship were linked up in several ways.
How?
Well, in the colonial period, it was generally the policy to apprentice someone to a person of the same religious faith.
Uh-huh.
Quakers were very insistent. In fact, if a father apprenticed his son to someone who was not a Quaker, they would read the family out of the church. So you had to keep this within the family.
It was a way of propagating the species.
The idea was, in the colonial period, religions were inherited. Mm-hmm. You had the same religion as your parents, and you were apprenticed to someone of the same religion, and the master was responsible for taking the apprentice to church.
What a contrast with what we've got today. People just pick them and choose them.
Oh, yes. But the interesting thing is, the change takes place while the institution of apprenticeship is in decline. One of the first acts of rebellion of youths against their masters is to insist upon the right to their own religion.
Or not to go to church.
Well, yes, except, you know, insisting in a society where most people went to church, to insist that you had the right not to go to church was to make you kind of a social outcast.
Uh-huh.
And besides, all the pretty girls went to church. Therefore, as one apprentice in one diary put it, the important thing was to be able to go to the church with the prettiest girls.
Uh-huh.
So one finds that apprentices around 1800 begin to shop around. The master goes to his particular church. The apprentice may attend a different church every Sunday, and he goes where his friends go. And maybe he no longer has the same religious affiliation as the master. This disappears. People are apprenticed to whomever they can be apprenticed to, and the parents don't care so much about this. And so the apprentice will sometimes, of course, he'll skip and not go to church, but he'll go to maybe a Baptist church in the morning and a Methodist church in the evening. And one of the reasons people go to church is there's nothing else to do on Sunday anyway. So it's an important part of the change. And one also finds that apprentices do convert to the religions of their masters,
mm-hmm.
In many cases. And this has all sorts of implications. It's one of the best ways to marry the master's daughter, for example.
That's right. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation with William Rorabaugh, a professor of history at the University of Washington. William Rorabaugh is the author of a forthcoming study about apprenticeship in America, a project he worked on during a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center. Soundings continues now with a discussion about another aspect of American beginnings. My guest on the following portion of the program is Seymour Cohen, a biochemist at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. Seymour Cohen recently completed a fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, where he worked on a forthcoming study entitled Thomas Cooper and the Chemical Revolution in America. Cooper lived from 1759 till 1839. He came to America in 1793, a dissenter from the Church of England. During the following 17 years, Cooper practiced law and established himself as one of the founders of American science, including medicine, geology, and chemistry. Cooper also became a friend of Thomas Jefferson, who called him one of the ablest men in America, and that in several branches of science. Here is Seymour Cohen.
I first learned about Cooper as a political prisoner in 1800. Cooper had been imprisoned by Adams under the Sedition Act for making certain remarks in print about his political opinions, which Adams took exception to. And then I learned that Cooper had subsequently been made a judge in the state of Pennsylvania after his release. And that seemed to me to be a queer, or at least unusual, sequence of events, particularly in our time. And it seemed to me that one might look into such a man. Cooper had been a chemist in the city of Manchester. He was what was commonly known as a dissenter, someone who did not ascribe to the test oath, which meant that he did not accept the... he was not willing to take the oath of allegiance to the Church of England or accept various premises required by the Church of England and by the Crown. Amongst such individuals were people like Joseph Priestley, who had been a famous chemist from Birmingham at about the same time, and Unitarian minister. And both Priestley, a chemist and minister in Birmingham, and Cooper were caught up in this. Now, Cooper was also a chemist. He was a manufacturing chemist who was the first to introduce the use of hypochlorite into bleaching of manufactured textiles. And indeed, his method of producing this bleaching fluid was a useful improvement on the methodology. It was sufficiently useful so that they kept it secret for a few years so that nobody else would catch on to it.
How would you characterize the intellectual cross currents between Europe and America, particularly in terms of Cooper's life and what he did in America?
As it happened, Joseph Priestley had made extraordinary contributions to chemistry in the years of 1770 to 1780. He had, by 1774, discovered oxygen, and in the next period had discovered such gases as nitrous oxide, nitric oxide, sulfur dioxide, ammonia, and indeed had made more discoveries in a very few years than most renowned scientists make in their lifetime. The extraordinary thing was that he was interpreting all of his results on the basis of a theory of chemistry which assumed the existence of some magical substance called phlogiston. Phlogiston was the stuff of which sensation was made of, and much of chemistry was interpreted in terms of this material, which no one had ever been able to see or weigh. But one could put together chemistry in a rather consistent picture, putting in assumptions based on the presence of phlogiston in a wide variety of things, such as metals. Now, Priestley had interpreted and continued to interpret all of his life chemistry in terms of the presence and active role of this material. And the French, by the very beginning of the 1780s, just before the French Revolution, had discovered, to their own satisfaction at that time and later to ours, that phlogiston simply didn't exist, that one could turn the entire picture on its head and now interpret what was happening to metals in a flame, for example, as a result of the acquisition of this gas from the air called oxygen, which Priestley had been the first to discover. Many chemists have wondered why Priestley was unable to make the transition himself to modern chemistry. I would throw into the general set of reasons, in addition to his own obduracy and intellectual resistance, the disturbance of the years in England in which he had to leave the country, and the fact that he was absolutely isolated in America. He had no possibility of personal criticism in his own work in his home, which was then the best laboratory and library in America.
Seymour Cooper is active as a scientist, and yet part of what you're writing about is his involvement with major political and cultural figures in the United States, people like Thomas Jefferson. How do these threads sort of interweave themselves?
Well, one of the first things I discovered when I decided to look into Cooper some time ago was a volume by a man who is now known as one of the most significant Jefferson scholars, namely Dumas Malone, who had written a dissertation on Cooper in 1923. And I've met Malone on several occasions, and Malone has told me some 15 years ago that he really didn't know enough about the chemistry, and so he decided to keep off that topic. That was something that was worth exploring. And when one begins to think then about Cooper having come to America with Priestley, the greatest English chemist, then his subsequent career in this country becomes a bit confusing, because it isn't until some 17 years later that Cooper emerges in this country as a full-blown chemist. He was an extraordinarily prolific man. Adams called him the most prolific man in America, actually. But Jefferson had called him the best educated man in America. And Cooper is the epitome of the 18th century man, even as was Priestley or Jefferson. But since Cooper fell more into my own field of specialization, I thought this might be an interesting way to start learning about the 18th century man. And Cooper has led me then through the Industrial Revolution in England, through the French Revolution, through the first years after the American Revolution, well into antebellum America.
Seymour, how would you characterize, in broad scientific or cultural terms, Cooper's legacy? What is it that scientists, people such as you, biochemists, you look back and you say, this is what we've inherited from a man like Thomas Cooper?
I think there are several ways of doing science, and that we've picked up a method which strikes me as not being entirely healthy. That is, it's possible to do science by examining some phenomenon and delving in deeper and deeper into a narrow and narrow sphere, which eventually will broaden out and perhaps lead to new kinds of generalizations. But there are people who look at the whole range of natural phenomena and will seek areas in which structure and solutions have not been found, and who will point to needs and problems and to the possibility of integration once those holes are filled. Once those lacunae are filled, then one can build new kinds of generalizations, which I think can be important.
And Cooper was such a man.
I think he thought in those kinds of terms, and there are very few of them operating in science today. I think, however, that this is inherently dangerous for the educational process. That is, we cannot hope to use overspecialized people for teaching a younger population who have to think broadly, who have to cope with problems that are rather large, extensive, beyond their immediate sphere of interest.
Seymour, you're coming dangerously close to making a case for liberal education for the humanities.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. But I think we've got a real problem on our hands.
In scientific education.
Right. Right. It seems to me that it would be, one could imagine the creation of courses in science, elementary courses for people who are not primarily scientists, which present the history of the development of ideas in a manner which would be very helpful, which would give them a basis for thinking about their own predicament, about the human condition, mm-hmm. as it were.
Seymour Cohen is a biochemist at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He's the author of a forthcoming study about Thomas Cooper, one of the founders of American science. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to discussions about two aspects of American beginnings. My guests were scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, William Rorabaugh of the University of Washington, and Seymour Cohen of the State University of New York at Stony Brook. For a cassette copy of Soundings on American Beginnings, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, conversations in recognition of Black History Month, February 1986. The Soundings panelists will include scholars from Howard University, Michigan State University, and Columbia University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center inviting you to join me this week for conversations about beginnings in American cultural and scientific history. My guests are two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. William Rorabaugh, the University of Washington, will discuss his forthcoming study about apprenticeship in early American society. And Seymour Cohen of the State University of New York at Stony Brook will discuss his new book about Thomas Cooper, one of the founders of modern scientific inquiry in the United States. Two aspects of American beginnings, this week on Soundings, from the National Humanities Center on this station.